Arthur, Arthur, Arthur. It's time. The Food Mitch. On Robin Hood Radio. None other than Arthur Schwartz, who has, I would say, a very devoted following. Hey, Arthur.
Thank you for that.
True.
Intro. Well, actually, you know, Mensch, the Pope of blessed memory, Pope Francis, basically once said that he just wanted to be remembered as a mensch. So it's a great honor to be called a mensch. So anyway, the mensch gets asked this question quite frequently, which is, do you always follow recipes? And the answer, the easy answer is no, but there's never an easy answer, as you know. So here's the thing. My job for the last 55 years has been to communicate about recipes, or to communicate recipes, among other things. And so I always approach a recipe with the idea that I may have to tell somebody how to do it, which means measuring. Now, I learned this from the beginning, even before I started being a professional food writer, that if I wanted to reproduce my grandmother, let's just start with grandma, who is, in fact, the model for this. If I wanted to be able to reproduce my grandmother's recipe, I had to cook alongside her, see what she did, but not only that, measure what she did. So if she was putting some salt in the palm of her hand, I wanted to get a teaspoon out and see if it was how much it really was. A half teaspoon, a teaspoon. You know, everybody will say, oh, a spoon of this, a spoon of that, a glass of this, a glass of that. But how big is the spoon? How big is the glass? Sidebar about the glasses. Many years into my career, when I was writing my Jewish cookbook, somebody wrote to me to say, you know, most of my recipes are a glass of this or a half a glass of that. And what was the glass? It was a Yahrzeit glass. That's the memorial candle. And I guess even now, they sell these memorial candles in a glass, which you can then reuse as a glass after the candle has gone away. But the candle technology has come a long way since my grandmother was burning Yahrzeit candles, and nowadays they don't need as big a glass for the wax for it to burn for a day. So, in fact, this woman wrote to me. She said, "I'm at a loss here because they've changed the size of the Yahrzeit glasses." But anyway, I measure everything. I must say there are certain things I don't these days because I can eyeball it 99% accurately. For instance, I can grab 4 ounces of pasta or say spaghetti, or 6 ounces of spaghetti. And if I weighed it, if I weighed it, I'm telling you, I would be within a strand or two of spaghetti from my goal. Because I've been eyeing this for so many years, I don't need to actually weigh it. But then again, I do. Or I often do. Especially if it's a new shape for me. I don't know what the volume is going to be. I would say most macaroni, if you want to do 2 servings, it's 2 cups. Dried. Anyway, so I don't, you know, always measure. And then again, I also believe in, and I love this expression, the continuity of the kitchen. That's an expression my dearly departed friend Barbara Kafka used to use. Barbara was way ahead of her time. She wrote the first important microwave cookbook. She also wrote a cookbook about roasting, in which she promoted 500-degree roasting, which then it was revolutionary, but now is sort of ordinary. And Barbara also knew that there were great American food products and opened a store on the Upper East Side called Star Spangled Food. It carried only American made products and grown products, but nobody was into that in the 1980s. Not nearly enough people to sustain a business on the Upper East Side. So it didn't last too long. And she was a restaurant consultant. Anyway, Barbara used to talk about the continuity of the kitchen, which is to say, you not everything is a recipe you start and end, and the ingredients are no more. Most of the time, you're making things, and there's either a leftover or some a half a head of this or blah, 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 and you make do with it the next day. I did this just recently. I was very proud of myself because I made something that only needed a half of a 28-ounce can of tomatoes, of plum tomatoes, and then I had a half a can left. It went into a plastic container in the refrigerator. If you don't use it up within a few days, it's going to turn moldy. So you got to use it up within a few days. I also made, because I've been getting great sweet red peppers at my supermarket at a very good price, meaning, I don't know, like $2.59 a pound. They're from Mexico, and they have been as sweet as the sweetest in midsummer red peppers or end of summer red peppers can be. So I've been roasting them. It doesn't take any more effort to roast six of them as it does to roast two. So I roast a lot of them at a time, not a lot, six, peel. I roast them in a 450-degree oven right directly on the rack, although I do have a sheet pan underneath that rack on the rack below in case any of them drip. And at 450 degrees, these particular peppers take 20 minutes, maybe 22 or 3 minutes. I do find that peppers vary in the time they need to roast. Sometimes they may need almost a half an hour at 450 degrees. You want them to be blotched with black. You want the skin to start turning black in spots. And then you take them out. I use tongs. And put them in a covered pot. People tell you to put them in a bag, plastic bag. I like a pot. It's right on top of the stove, and you put the peppers in, you cover the pot, and when they cool down to room temperature, you take the skins right off. You've got these particular peppers aren't full of seeds, gotta say, which is nice too. So I what I call fillet the peppers, spread them out on a relatively flat platter. And I dress them. This is not all the time, but most of the time. I dress them right away with olive oil, salt, and either chopped garlic or slivered garlic. We'll get to garlic in a minute. And then this time I put some oregano on, too. Just a few pinches, a pinch per layer. Anyway, I had all these nice peppers. We ate them for their own sake. But I still had a lot more, and I had the tomatoes, and what do? I'm going to make chicken cacciatore. So I, in fact, had just bought four chicken thighs in the supermarket, and the continuity of the kitchen. I used my leftover peppers. I used my leftover tomatoes. I did not follow a recipe. I just browned the chicken in a skillet. In a deep sauté pan that has a cover. I brown the chicken. I usually takes about 7 minutes on the skin side, and then I do 1 minute on the other side. And in this case, I took the chicken out after it browned, and I put in my my tomatoes, which were not crushed yet, so I crushed them right up in the pan. It also acts to deglaze the pan. Oh, by the way, I did throw off some of the fat that accumulated from browning the chicken. I didn't want it too greasy. But I left a tablespoon or so in the pan for the tomatoes, crushed them up in the pan, put the chicken back in the pan, and let it simmer, skin side up, for about 20, 25 minutes. And then I put in the roasted peppers that I had left from the day before, cut into strips. They were already dressed with garlic and oil and oregano. Added a lot to my sauce. And that was it. Let it cook for another 10 minutes with the peppers mixed in. And I got to say, it was maybe the best cacciatore I've ever made. And it was, I know, besides the quality of the ingredients, the fact that it didn't have too much going on in it. I don't like too much going on these days. You too, Jill? Because I feel as we get older, we edit more and we want simpler food. How do you feel about that? You don't feel about that?
Sorry.
You have no feelings about that? Using less. I mean, I'm happy to have plain old roasted chicken with nothing but salt and pepper. And people say, you don't do anything more than that. I said, well, I don't really feel I need more than that. Anyway, so that brings me to the subject of tomato sauce. People put way too much stuff in their tomato sauce. Do I ever follow a recipe for tomato sauce? Rarely. Only recently I did, however, because there was this incredible buzz going on online about Marcella Hazan's already famous tomato sauce with butter and onion. And I felt all these people are saying it's the living end sauce. I better try it again. I have to say, every decade or so, I try it again. And every decade or so, I say the same thing. So that's following a recipe. Well, if you want to know what the recipe is, it's just a can of tomatoes with an onion. I think you just cut the onion in half or in quarters and put it in the pot. And a lot of butter. And you simmer it for 10 minutes or so, and that's it. It's too buttery for me. Now, my tomato sauce needs to be done with olive oil. And not butter. It's just what my palate is accustomed to. Do I ever follow a recipe? Rarely. It depends on what tomatoes I have in the house, how I'm going to approach this tomato sauce. And got to say, lately, when I've been able to buy these really good cherry tomatoes, I've been going towards cherry tomato sauce as opposed to plum tomato sauce. I love canned tomatoes. Fresh tomatoes, now I noticed the other day that in my supermarket, the fresh plum tomatoes were very, very cheap. And when I came home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but my next-door neighbor said, she bought some of those but warned me away from them. I said, you didn't have to warn me away. They were too cheap. So, I mean, sometimes you get suspicious, and I was skeptical about these. However, when you can get a good plum tomato, there's nothing like a fresh plum tomato sauce. So I approach tomato sauces like, what do I have? What am I going to put in it? Am I going to use a fresh tomato? Am I going to use a cherry tomato, canned tomato? Nowadays, you can buy canned cherry tomatoes, which are really pretty good. There are all kinds of tomatoes in a can these days. And I like almost all of them, except for some of the American brands are too watery for me. But I have to say, I just read yet another canned tomato tasting, and Red Pack, again, I think it's because Red Pack tomatoes come in a thick puree, and they're sweet. They're California. There's nothing wrong with California tomatoes, and people love them. I prefer the more acidic but well-balanced San Marzano tomatoes. Now, the beauty of San Marzano tomatoes, the real ones, which is to say a different variety than the Roma tomatoes that are mostly put in cans, San Marzano are very pulpy and not that seedy. So all my old recipes that say to seed canned tomatoes, I forget about it. You don't need to do that. In fact, even in my book, Naples at Table, it tells you to drain your canned tomatoes because back 25 years ago when I wrote the book, canned tomatoes were mostly packed in juice, which meant that if you used all the juice, you had to cook the sauce that much longer to reduce all that juice down to a thick puree. Nowadays, even mediocre tomatoes come in thick puree. So you don't have to do that anymore. Anyway, I do like a canned tomato sauce, but let's go back to a fresh tomato sauce with cherry tomatoes because I add a lot of different things, and I really do not follow a recipe. But I happened to buy recently some really extraordinary capers packed in salt. from an island, a Sicilian island called Pantelleria, famous for capers. I found them online, and I've been using them here and there, and certainly with my cherry tomatoes. So how I do that is I start off by cooking some garlic, or even a lot of garlic, sliced garlic, usually, in a good amount of olive oil, and just for 1 or 2 minutes until the oil becomes fragrant, I mean the garlic becomes fragrant. And then I add the cherry tomatoes, a big pinch of salt, cover the pan, increase the heat, and shake the pan like it's popcorn. By the way, if the tomatoes are, sometimes I have them, sometimes I don't. You don't have to, if you don't mind a pulpy sauce. So it takes about, not much more than about 5 minutes covered over fairly high heat. You don't want to burn the garlic. For you'll hear the tomatoes cooking. And once they start cooking, you can uncover the pan, and they'll form a very chunky, nice sauce, to which you can add, let's start with some capers, which I rinse and then soak a bit to get rid of a lot of the salt. So how about some olives? Gaeta olives are my favorite olive for cooking. They're freestone, so you can pinch them and get the pit out, and then just cut them in half or in quarters, not too small. Of course, you want an herb. I always have good oregano in the house, but if you have a fresh herb, you know, some chopped parsley or even chopped basil at the end. What else can I put in there? Tuna. So if we want a dish that has some protein in it as well, at the end, chunk in 1 can of drained tuna. I buy skipjack or light tuna in olive oil. By the way, mostly comes from Thailand. If you look at the bottom of the can, you can often see where it comes from. So most of our, I must say, canned tuna these days comes from Southeast Asia. So you chunk that up into the sauce, and that's it. Now, I like that with a macaroni. How about mezze half? Rigatoni, they're short rigatoni. Penne is good. Regular rigatoni is good. Ziti is wonderful. If you want spaghetti, you can do spaghetti. But just to say, although the flavors will coat all the strands of spaghetti, a chunky sauce like this does not integrate that well with spaghetti. You end up with, you know, having to divvy up the goodies at the end after serving the pasta itself. You can put an extra drizzle of fresh extra virgin olive oil over the top. Not necessary for me because I use a good amount of oil to start. Anyway, I do all of that without recipes. And I guess I do a lot of cooking without recipes. But as I said, my job is to communicate recipes. So I do have to be very conscious of what I'm doing all the time, and in the end, yes, I have a recipe. I think I'm sort of an idiot savant when it comes to recipes. I can't remember a lot of things. But I do remember recipes after I've made them. Well, usually I know the recipe well enough by the time I go to the kitchen to make it that I probably can make it without looking at the recipe. But certainly the first time I'm making something new, I will follow the recipe, and then it's in my head, and I can do a little variation on it, like I'm doing right now with the brownies that I mentioned a few weeks ago. I'm totally stuck on these brownies, so I've been buying different chocolate and to make it with different chocolate, and I also made them with walnuts, and I think I mentioned when you make it with nuts, you got to increase the baking time a little bit. But anyway, this recipe is embedded in my brain, so I don't need a recipe to follow.
So I have a sort of cooking philosophy question.
Yes.
I had a lot of friends back in the day who wrote cookbooks, and then all the recipes were tested and so forth.
Right.
I have never really been, I, I'm I don't know if this is the real meaning of it, but I'm more of a scratch cook. It's like I've got this and this and this ingredients, and I remember such and such, and so I'm going to make thus and such.
Yeah.
And if I make something that I like, then I know the recipe because I have made it, and I guess somebody can come and do the measurements, and that's that. But I wonder if that's just a different type. That's the philosophical question. Just a different approach to the kitchen, you know, because you watched your grandparents cook. Marshall watched his aunts and grandmothers cook. I watched my I learned a lot of my interest came from watching. And
yes, me too.
And I'm wondering.
But I was also given chores. You know, my grandmother and my mother would find something for me to do.
Grind the potato. Do the potatoes for the potato pancake.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that, because I've always wondered how do people just pick recipes if you can't read the recipe, and know what certain things are going to happen. How do you know that it's going to be?
Oh, I don't know.
And I had a friend who, with all due respect to her culinary skills, you know, would decide. Give a dinner party, she'd get the people, and then she would find a recipe that she wanted to make, and then she would follow it. And
that's dangerous, I always think.
No kidding. But she was not open to any guidance.
I don't know. I'm fortunate. People ask me how I got into this to begin with. I'm fortunate. I grew up in a family that was food obsessed. So even though my mother didn't love to cook the way her mother did. Her mother lived downstairs, so I had an example of my grandmother cooking. And my mother was a pretty good cook, that said. But what I learned from my mother was how to eat out.
The old joke, reservations.
My mother always said, we don't go out to get better food. We go out because we're going to get served, and somebody else is going to do the dishes. And I totally understand that now, because I have not been getting better food eating out at all. In fact, I've been quite disappointed lately. And then I have to come home and cook just to reassure myself that there is good food out there. I have this terrible thing. If I eat something in a restaurant that isn't very good, I got to go home and make it good. So within limits, that is. I recently bought some at my butcher. My butcher cooks, and he's Calabrese, and he makes very good Southern Italian food that he sells in the butcher shop. And one of the things that he had a sign in the window the other day, made today, tripa alla romana, Roman style. So that is the most successful not made at home thing I've eaten in the last month. Was my butcher's tripe Roman style, which was quite good. And I got to eat it in the comfort of my own home.
And you didn't have to clean the tripe yourself.
Well, you know, it was just a container of tripe. What did I do? I heated it in a saucepan and I put it in a bowl. So it wasn't a lot of cleanup.
That's reasonable.
And now, you know, the city of New York, here's a big issue with me right now. The city of New York has decided that we must, by pain of a fine, compost. You guys know about this? So I asked recently at our co-op meeting how to go about this. And, you have to figure you're going to keep some creepy garbage in your apartment for a little bit before you can dump it downstairs in a special bin. I haven't figured this out yet, but we eat so many vegetables that I will be producing an awful lot of compost here. And one of my neighbors said, she puts it in her freezer until she takes it out. Well, I only have a tiny freezer. I'm not putting garbage in my freezer, even if it's just fresh vegetable garbage. Okay. So I thank you all for being patient with me.
And
you can all write to me at mmiles@robinhoodradio.com. M as in Mary, Miles, M-I-L-E-S. And here's something I'm making today without a recipe. I'm making asparagus. I'm making pasta with asparagus and ham and cream. This is one of Bob's favorite things in life, and I don't use a recipe for it. I bought a quarter-inch thick slab of really good Italian ham, not prosciutto, but cooked, and I'll use some of that. I will start by cutting up my asparagus to see, and it's all going to be in proportion to the amount of asparagus I have. So I'll tell you, I would say it's going to be 2 cups of asparagus cut into 1-inch pieces, and then I'll saute that in some butter. I'll throw in the ham when the asparagus are tender, and then finally, and after throwing that around the pan a little bit, I'll add some glugs of cream, heavy cream, and that's it, with pasta and a lot of grated cheese.
It sounds really good. What kind of pasta?
I think I'm making those half rigatonis.
Okay.
I have a few different. Gemelli might be good. I have a bag of gemelli here. I really love to do this with penne, and I cut the asparagus like they were penne on a diagonal. And it's just cute to me, that's all. Doesn't really. Well, you know, if you cut them on the bias, they cook much quicker. An advantage. And they don't take very long to cook. When you cook them in a skillet with butter or oil.
That's good guidance.
And I'm doing this with butter and not oil because, I don't know, creamy things to me call for butter. Although I do know a recipe that I'll never make it. It's too much work. But it's these pumpkin-filled tortelloni in a sauce of both cream and olive oil. Butter. I mean, every rich thing you can think of. Yeah, of course, it's from the far north. Okay, everybody. Happy Easter week. All the feasting is over.
We're actually on to the next now. Feasting
What's
is over.
The next holiday?
Holy Week was last week.
Yeah.
Which culminated in Easter.
Yeah.
For everyone.
Okay.
And here we are.
I wonder what it means that the Pope died on Easter. Does that have any significance? And anyway, I don't think there are any holidays coming up. Well, there's Mother's Day, which, by the way, is the busiest restaurant day of the year.
Right. When we get to that, we will. And I think that might be the 11th. I don't have a calendar in front of me.
Well, that's only 2 weeks away.
But we can definitely talk about restaurant days, because I think very few people know that. About
know what?
That Mother's Day is the biggest restaurant day.
Oh.
I think that if you were trying to win money at a bar, people would give a difference.
Do you know what the second most is? I do.
I'm guessing Thanksgiving, but I have no idea.
Yeah, well, you'd be guessing accurately.
What?
Mother's Day is first, Thanksgiving is second. I don't know what third is. It's not Father's Day, by the way.
No.
Father's Day is, fathers need to, fathers, on Mother's Day, fathers take mothers out to eat, and on Father's Day, fathers cook for mothers.
They grill. Thank you very much, Arthur Schwartz.
Bye.
The Food Mensch on Robin Hood Radio.